I think this critical mass is pretty high up, right, this room, so I'm glad you guys all made it out here. I was worried that we wouldn't find it, or that I wouldn't find it. But then again, Everest makes sense. Now I know why it's called Everest, this room. Okay, I think we're on time. I'll go ahead and start, and if a couple more people come in, that's okay. So why are we here? C++. Everyone here programs in C++ every day, or what kind of crowd am I looking at here? Yeah? Okay. So at the end of this, you might find that you're far more expert than I am. It's possible. But at least we'll all be happy that this is the language you like to talk about. So the context today is kind of interesting. So C++, first of all, is undergoing a new standard and very close to completion. And on the other hand, the environment is kind of interesting nowadays, right? So there's a lot of devices, there's a plethora of kinds of experiences that people want. They want the performance, they want all those kinds of things. And so I think it puts us in an interesting place that not only is the language still very, very relevant, it's actually growing in a lot of different specific areas. So let's first talk about where the language is. So how many of you have actually been keeping up with the last 10 years of the standardization process of C++? No? But it's fascinating stuff. The ISO community really runs a great operation. It takes a really long time. You have to go through all these steps in order to get a new standard. Now, for C++, this is a good thing in some ways because, you know, adding features to the language is not that easy. Right? We are a large enough language that you have to actually take a lot of time and a lot of review, and the specs are like software. They have a lot of bugs, and they have to be ironed out, and it takes years. And so after all these years, we thought this standard would come out, you know, sometime between 2000 and 2009. So it was called C++ 0x. That's how we've been talking about it all these years. And so far, we've accomplished all these pieces of the standardization. And so, you know, it's a pretty good state to be in. So much so that now we're happy and like confident that we can call it C++ 11 or 2011. So it'll come out, it'll be done probably by the end of the summer. We're just at the last stages of voting, but at this point it's a done deal. Now it's a really, really big standard. It's a huge change to the language. And there's no way, first of all, that I can talk about all of it. It's going to take a few years for all the compilers to get every little bit of functionality into it, but it's an amazing kind of change in the language. So when I was thinking about how to give a talk about this topic, first of all, I had to think about what is our team and what is Microsoft and what do I think that the industry, how does it perceive C++? And there's a few different things. The way I think we see it is this is the ultimate language for power and performance. If you want to have access to any device, right? If it can plug into a PC and you want to do something with it, C++ is there. You don't have to wait for it to be wrapped as part of some larger API. It's always going to give you unlimited access to the hardware. And today, when you think of Kinect and you think of accelerometers and you think of all the different kinds of devices that you have to interact with, this is a tremendous advantage. On the other hand, like all native languages, there's a lot of them nowadays, but performance is the key, right? Performance is what makes it different, I think, than most other languages. With C++, you can achieve similar performance with other languages, but you can always be sure that with C++ and native code, you're going to have the best possible performance. So it's important for us to evaluate kind of this standard and where we're going with the language, I think, in light of these two areas. And of course, it's power and performance on any platform, right? Here I'm talking about Windows and Visual Studio, but of course, I think we all know that C++ is probably like one of the best solutions for writing cross-platform applications today. At least if you care for them to be fast and good and on every platform. Now, I looked around on the web to see what other people might think. What is C++ today? You know, how would you define it? So I came across this definition, which I think is not bad, you know. It's not terribly positive about the language, but it's still true. Right? We are the fastest thing out there. So then I was like, okay, well, this is maybe not the best way to describe the language that I'm going to try to talk about today. So I thought, why don't we ask the inventor? And this is specifically in terms of the new standard. And Bjarne actually had these really, really great comments. And they kind of, these two struck out at me. I kept them on the slide. The first is that a lot of pieces are now coming together with this new, with the new improvements to the language, such that certain things now feel a lot more natural. And that's what I think what he's trying to say here. And we'll go and look at some of these. Without ever losing that efficiency is kind of the key point, though. In C++, we don't actually add new high-level language features if we can't implement them in such a way that you will still get the machine performance, right? That's the philosophy of the language. Another interesting point that he makes is if we keep talking and learning the language, talking about it and learning of it in the old way, which was thinking of it as just a slightly modified C, you're really not getting the full benefit anymore. And I think this is true. I think the language has really grown out of C with classes. That was kind of a simple way of looking at it. And it has enough unique value now that if you just think of it as C with some stuff, with type safety, or if you just think of it as object-oriented, you're not going to get the full measure of the language. So I thought about this and I was like, okay, well, instead of just talking about what's new, which is kind of how we tend to do a lot of these talks, and, you know, for lots of the features in the new standard, you could spend an hour on each one talking about what's new in that specific domain. I only have an hour to talk about kind of the whole thing. So the way I'm going to do it is by kind of starting over a little bit. And I'm going to actually walk through some of the like really base concepts and look at them through the new capabilities of the language that are now there and how it makes these original things that were always in C++ better. Okay? So the first one is values. So this piece of code, whether you're a C# developer on the side or also, you know, I'm okay with you being a mainstream C# developer. Does this code look funny? Like, does this look wrong, right? Would you write this? No, right? This looks pretty ridiculous, I think. You would never think that an int is going to be null. In fact, it will never be null. If you compile this with C++, if you make that a null pointer, this is actually a C# snippet, this will tell you that there's a type mismatch, right? That X and null and void star, you know, they can't be the same. And in C#, it'll allow you to compile this and tell you something about how this will always be false. So they're okay with you doing it anyway. And now this looks ridiculous, and you would never write this code, but this seems reasonable, right? In a lot of languages, you would write this. So what's so different about your type and int? And in most languages, this is a clear separation, right, between user types and primitive types. And the way they behave is very, very different from the way yours get to behave. But in C++, it was always a core design goal to say your types can behave like built-in types. And those built-in types, the way they behave is they behave like values. So, if you look at definitions of the word value, there's, of course, lots of ways to look at it. And I think the simple way I think about it is they're basically the data itself, rather than something about the storage of the data or the lifetime of the data, or all these kinds of things that you associate with variables. Values are just the data itself. Now, they're very popular in things like functional programming, and of course, most primitive types in any language are implemented as values. So another way to look at values, if you wanted to increase them beyond primitive types, is that they tend to have deep copy semantics, right? Like they're always fully describing what they're supposed to be. So in C++, like I said, you can operate on your types like values. And this is a really, really important part of the language. It's what makes the language work really well. And all it requires is a little bit of thinking on your part, right? It's not a lot of work, and that's what we'll just walk through real quick, which is I made this cool game. It's a command line game in which I'm going to have a bunch of gladiators, and we're going to have them fight. So something really, really simple, where we'll be able to explore this concept about programming with values. So I'll move out to Visual Studio here. Can everyone read that? All the way in the back, this font's good enough? Okay. So here's kind of my version zero of this app. And you'll notice it has a fighter, right? Very, very simple structure. By the way, along the way, remember I said I have no time to talk about every single feature of the language. But as I go along, you're going to notice certain things that might be new that you haven't seen, and I'll point them out. So for example, here I have an unordered map. This is a new C++ library feature, which is essentially a hash table. It was supposed to get in the language in 1994, but they weren't too confident about hash tables in 1994 yet. They knew they wanted it. They weren't confident that their implementation was good, so it didn't go in. And now it's in. And because now it's in after 15 years, they're worried about overlapping names. Yeah, they were worried that they were going to, you know, break your code. So we went with this name, unordered map, which is just trying to tell you that it is a map, but you can't rely on element ordering. And it happens to have O1 lookup. So another thing that I have here is a quick function, totally, you know, not doing what it says it's supposed to do, which is tell you between two fighters who's the stronger one. But for now, I don't care. And what I want you to notice, and again, for experienced C++ developers, this is not going to sound new, right? But this is a free function, right? It's living in the namespace. It's not in a class. C++ is not about tying you down to object-oriented if that's not what's right for your scenario. And then I have my arena, which is a vector of fighters, and then I'm just constructing it. And then I have this one function. Really, that whole app is this one function, where I'm going to select two fighters and have them fight. Now, what's notable here as well, which you may have seen this really funny characters here, is another library feature of C++ 11 is having a proper random library built in. So, you know, doing basic random stuff when you're building prototype code is nice and easy. You don't need any help there. You can get the clock and you just call the rand function. But when you're trying to do real random stuff and you're worried about the corner cases, and you want to be uniform, or you want to have a normal distribution, all these kinds of things that the further you go down, you know, random, you really need, the library provides. And this typedef over here of 19937 is actually an implementation of the Mersenne twister, which is kind of the accepted best random number generator algorithm today for non-cryptographic purposes. So I'm just finding, you know, two fighters from my list, and then I'm returning who's the strongest. And my game is really, really simple. I just create the arena and get the fighter out of the tournament, and let me just make that my startup mode is. And I can run this, and I have my cool ASCII art, and it says, I constructed an arena, started a tournament, fighter was victorious, and that's the end of that. So what I wanted to mention is, now, there's nothing fancy in this code, right? This is really, really, really basic code. And it's not doing anything interesting yet. But everything I was doing in that code was operating on fighter and arena like a value. I didn't have to have a pointer to a fighter. I didn't have to think about how it works. I have a fighter. I know. It has a name. It's always going to be like that. If it's not, you know, if I haven't given it a different name, it's going to just have blank as its name. Or whatever I've initialized it to. In this case, blank. Like the OS, the compiler will do that for you. So you'll tell me now, this is really simple. This is just a piece of data. This is not an interesting struct, right? It has no behavior. It has no dynamic data of its own. It's not polymorphic. I mean, there's all these things that it's not doing yet. So this is not very impressive, I would agree. So what I wanted to do is say, well, let's imagine our fighter had some dynamic data. How would we deal with it then? So now you get something like this, right? And so I'm just gonna make it simple. Our fighter has some loot, yeah, some dynamic, you know, piece of loot, and maybe it's huge, maybe it's not, unclear yet. And when I initialize them in the constructor, so now I have my own constructor. So now I'm basically just walking through very simply, and some of this is gonna be a refresher for everyone, the things you need to do to still maintain the value semantics that we had in the previous example. So all I'm doing here really is assigning some stats. I'm actually giving him some random health and strength, and creating, right, I'm initializing my bag of money, And that's what this character array is. I don't really care about filling it with anything. I'm just allocating a bunch of data, right? So having this constructor is already a good step. This means I can continue to create the type on the stack, which is really important. It doesn't work, though, if I want to assign it from another one, right, or copy it from another fighter. And you need to have that in order to have value semantics. So then I can look at our copy constructor, right? You guys have all written this, I know, a bunch of times. And all I'm doing in here, right, is pretty simple. I'm initializing my stats with the other person's stats and my name with the other person's name. And I'm copying the full array. So there's definitely a lot of data being copied over here. Now, if I want to do the equal part, right, if I want to go A equals B, which is something you can do with values, you need to also be able to assign it. So that's the third thing you got to implement. And the way I implemented it is very simple. I take another fighter, and I swap my members with his members. And this is what this little swap function does. And this is a really practical way of doing things, just in case you write these kinds of types all the time, which I hope you do, is to write your swap function, because it'll allow you to centralize how you get from one to the other, and you'll reuse it in different parts of your code. So now, this is all well and good, right? And I can compile this, and we'll run this. And that works just fine, same as before. And if you look at the code down here, the arena hasn't really changed at all. There's my cool ASCII art, right? And I'm just initializing a game and running it, and that's it. So what I wanted to do, though, is take a look at this perf test. Because one of the problems that, if you're familiar with this kind of programming, might be is that data. What if that data is really, really big? What if I'm allocating really big characters, really big arrays of money, in this case, in this story. And every time I take a fighter or get a fighter or move a fighter, you know, it's copying all that data. This seems like a bad idea. It works really well for integers, but is that really a good idea for this class? So, sorry, perf test should be running. Oh, that's right. We're still on the other one. Classic. So now I'm running this perf test at the end, right? And it's just shuffling and sorting and shuffling and sorting and shuffling and sorting my vector of fighters, right? The fighters were these values. And what you see here is that it took 2.5 seconds to create the 1,000 fighters, and that's allocating all the data associated with that fighter. And then it took 157 milliseconds on average to sort that list. And that's a really long time. And the reason for that is that we just have a lot of data, right? In fact, the way you can see this is, you know, every time a fighter is constructed, right, in an arena of size 50, so it's constructed 50 times, but you're noticing that it's being copied 75 times. And the reason is vectors grow, right? Vector is not an array. It's not a fixed size. So as I was pushing back fighters into my array, into my vector, the vector was going from size 1 to 2 to 4 to 8, 16. And as it's doing that, it actually has to copy, because it's creating a new thing and copying the members down. And so it's actually quite expensive. So what do we do, right? Up until this standard, there was no good way in C++ to deal with this problem. And this was one of the quick things where you decided, well, forget value, you know, semantics, and I'm just going to go and use pointers and allocate this dynamically. But that's not really practical, right? You can't have a vector of pointers, and that's really, really, you know, impractical. You can, but it's just not fun. So C++ 11 has a really good solution for this problem. And it comes from the realization that the issue here is the problem is not that the copy is expensive, it's that we're doing unnecessary copies. You don't really need to copy when you're resizing a vector, right? You should be able to take the dynamic data that it's pointing to and simply swap it with a new node. And that's where move constructors come in. So C++ now has this ability of saying, refer to something as an R value. R values are things that cannot be assigned to. And that often would mean like a temporary. Right? If you're going A plus B plus C, you know, those are getting merged, right? B and C are getting plussed first, and then A plus the result of that is getting plussed, and then that's getting assigned into your variable. That's creating all these temporaries that have no need to exist outside of that scope. So you can steal their contents. So that's what I'm going to do here. So I'm going to show you how to implement a move constructor. Right? And you're going to notice it's really quite easy. So instead of taking a reference to another fighter, I'm going to take an R value reference to another fighter. Right? Whoops. Fighter T. Fighter T. So that looks pretty simple, right? It's almost mimicking the other one. And how do I initialize this? Well, I'm going to say that my loot, I'm going to initialize to null pointer. You'll notice that we have an actual null pointer type now, so you don't have to keep reusing null, which didn't really make sense. And inside of this, all I'm going to say is I'm going to increase my move constructor count so we can count these, and I'm going to swap. Right? That's all I'm doing. And so what's going to happen here is I'm not going to allocate a giant array. I'm simply going to steal the other one's head pointer, and I will take over his array. Make sense? So now, if I run this again, hopefully I got this right, we'll run through this perf test, and you'll see it took 3 milliseconds on average. So that's like two orders of magnitude improvement in this specific case. I can't obviously say this is always true. It really depends on the kind of the way the data feels, right? If the data is such that you have a small amount of members in the type, and then something very, very large that you're connected to, that you're like pointing to, then this becomes very, very practical. This is also really practical for things that can't be copied. So this is another interesting case, right? So this is where it's expensive to copy my fighter, so I've solved that problem. But what if I had a resource, a type, that, again, I want to operate in the same way, but I can't copy it? And good examples of this would be, well, I'll show you one, would be files, right? So if I come back to here, a file can't be copied, right? Because you have this file handle and it doesn't make sense to copy that. So that'd be a case of where your type needs to not be copied, but it can be moved. There's no reason the file handle can't come over to another type if that's the way it goes. And so you can put vectors of files into your code and it'll work. And I'll show you what that code would look like. But what I didn't put in that fighter, in that example, you may have noticed, and I didn't put a destructor, right? So that was actually really terrible code, and I was leaking like, you know, probably a gigabyte while that code was running. And that's because that's kind of two parts to the destructor like point. The first is that it completes the value, you know, semantics part that I was showing you before, which is once you add the destructor in there, the resources will be released, which is kind of key. You need to be able to delete that array or release a file handle, something like that. And this is actually something where C++ gets it really, really right, because resource management, right, is a broader problem than just garbage collection. And, you know, one of my colleagues had this great line, which is, just because someone is cleaning the street for you, right, there's a street sweeper, doesn't mean you just throw stuff on the ground. And garbage collection is great up to a point. It handles memory really well. It doesn't deal with resources. And C++ deals with resources really, really well. So let's walk through what that would look like. So here's two ways to open a file, right? One in C#, one in C++. Actually, the lower one is classic, you know, C style, almost. So you'll notice I'm using the auto keyword, right? So I can infer what F is. It really looks exactly like the C# code, right? So can anyone tell me if there's something wrong with this code? No? It's good? This is what you would write? No? Okay. So you might get an exception, right? And you're not closing the file. There's two problems there. So what do? This is the same in C#. So in C# you would do the thing on the left over there. So, you know, you'd have to try catch block, and in the try you'd open the file, write to the file, and you'd catch the exceptions. And in the finally clause, you'd have to go, you know, close the file. In C++, it's not that different, really, when you look at this. If I just wanted to take the same code and make it correct, I'd also have to have the close call in my catch, probably also outside of the catch in case there was no exception thrown. So not terribly ideal. We don't have the finally concept here for C++. But you get, this is the correct behavior. It's not really great. So the C# people and the Java people came up with one solution, and C++ has what I think is a more elegant solution. So in C#, this is what you do to be better, right? You write this using statement. And that's basically just saying, if the file stream, right, f, has a dispose function, then it will be called as soon as, oh no, maybe not as soon actually, somewhat after you close the curly brace. So it will be called, but you can't control when. So the file will be closed in this case, so your code is safe in that respect. But you have no context of when it will be closed. And that can be a big problem if you're sharing these files, or you really need them to be released as soon as that curly brace is closed. In C++, this is what it would look like, right? If you had a proper file class written the same way I wrote that fighter class, which has constructor and a destructor, and in the constructor you would acquire the file, and in the destructor you would release the file, close the file, you would have code like this. And this would work in the presence of exceptions, and it just works, right? It works with stack semantics. In other words, when that scope is closed, the file will be closed. So let me go ahead and add my destructor back in here, just in case I come back to this code. And you know exactly what that would look like, right? It would just be, right? And we would just go delete loot. And I can count my destructors. And so if I run this again, this time I won't leak the code. You'll see that I'm not even writing out my stats correctly. Look at our stats. Right? And if we look at this, we're going to see that I'm now creating an arena of 50 fighters, and that means that 50 fighters are constructed. 9 times they were copied because I was pulling them out of the vector and doing stuff with them, right? Like picking 2 to do a fight and stuff like that. They were destroyed 125 times because that includes all those temporaries that were created. And it was moved 66 times. As the vector was resizing, those were a bunch of moves. Now, the move doesn't mean you're not constructing one, right? You're still constructing a temporary. I just wanted to be clear. But the temporary was cheap because it wasn't allocating that giant dynamic array. So if you didn't have that dynamic data, then copy and move will be very, very similar in cost. All right. So this is kind of, to me, one of the key elements of C++ that is one of the only languages in the world that gets this really right, which is destructors and the semantics of how those work, which is that they're deterministic. They run exactly where you know they're going to run. Well, they're invisible, right? You don't explicitly call them, but you know when they're going to run, and you can depend on that. And in our day and age, when you have talking to the GPU, talking to files, talking to the network, these are not unlimited resources, right? Memory was kind of a special case. There's a lot of it, and you kind of people want to be lazy with it. But resources are not like that. And so C++ actually gives you a tremendous advantage when you use it this way. So it's really, really valuable to take every resource that you use in your code. Anytime you see yourself with, you know, this kind of a delete call or a close call that you have to remember to do, wrap that into a class. It doesn't take that long to write a class this way, right? Just a little bit of thinking, and you get this. 5 functions you have to write. And then you get the great semantics. You can just write file f, and it looks good, and it works well. So it's kind of a win-win. Now, one thing you may ask yourself is how do we think about the lifetime here? So if I put it on the stack, that's great. It has stack lifetime. I can make it static, right? And that will have static kind of lifetime. Or I can make it a global variable, and that will have kind of global lifetime. But what about in between, right? The whole value semantic stuff breaks down, it seems, if I want to have some kind of intermediate lifetime, something that is, well, you know, for as long as I need it. I don't want it right away, but when I want it, I want it to stay for as long as I need it. And this seems like a totally normal thing to ask for. And so again, in C++, there was no way to do this. Not in the language, sorry? Lambdas?
Members.
Members. Well, a member would be the lifetime of the class, but when you allocate, right, when you create something, if you want it to live on as soon, if you want it to be alive as soon as you create the type, then perfect. It's like the loot that I had in the fighter. And its lifetime is tied exactly to a fighter. And the fighter gets destructed, the loot goes away. What if I wanted to have loot that lived beyond that fighter? Right? This is not that weird, really, this need to have something that has kind of more complex lifetime. Dynamic allocate. This is exactly right. So the way you do this is you allocate dynamically. You go new, right? This is actually absolutely correct. But that's also error prone, right? Now you have to get back into resource management. Oh, if I knew, then I got to remember to delete. And you have that problem. So in C++ 11, and actually we've had this in our product since 2008, because it was kind of ratified a long time ago, is this idea of a shared pointer, right? And this is just a pointer with ref counting semantics that will do the right thing. In other words, it will construct and destruct your types exactly the way you expect it. It's part of Boost, and it's been part of Visual C++ and the standard for some time now. So we've had it in our product since 2008 SP1, and it's a formal part of the standard. So it used to be called Technical Report 1. It's in the same part of the standard where the random library goes and the regular expression library goes, and there's a whole bunch of new libraries. Like I said, I can't even go over all of them. So I just want to show you what that means with my last iteration on this arena. So here, it's the same code. Actually, I filled this one in completely. So I, in fact, made my loot its own class that manages just that array, right? So it's really clean. And I just want to jump down to the arena. And you'll notice that it's a vector of pointers to fighter. And the fighter pointer is really just a shared pointer of fighter, okay? And everywhere else in the code that looked like it was dealing with a fighter, fighter T, and it was dealing with things by value and copying it around and all that great, semantics of just put something on the stack and use it, those still exist. They just happen to be with the shared pointer. So it's not a pointer here that I do. It's not a reference. It's every time I take something out of this list, I'm probably going to make a copy out of it, right? If I go A equals fighters 0, right, like I take the first element, that's a copy. But it's a copy of the shared pointer. So it's really all it's doing is incrementing the ref count. And as soon as it all goes away, the memory is given back to you. And so all of this code still only has that one delete call, which is for creating the array, right? There's no calls to delete anywhere in this application. And if I run this, I think this one's a bit more interesting. Yes. We'll get to that. I just want to say it still works, right? So that was all zeros, but trust me, this still works. My point is that simply by using things like shared pointer, you can get kind of the lifetime, all the different kinds of lifetime that you need, either stack or part of your class, or shared across things that need to be not necessarily created right away, right? Because you might not be contextually correct. Maybe I don't have loot until I do my first kill, and so that's when I get my loot. Maybe loot is a global thing that like everyone gets to kind of take from, and it's shared across the arena, but not necessarily my entire application. So I don't want it to be a true global, right? All these kinds of different things you can do. And shared pointer does the right thing. Everyone can write their own, right? And people over the years have written their own smart pointers. But there's no point in you trying to capture all the corner cases. Shared pointer will just work. So that's my whole spiel. I was going to kind of go on and on and on about, I think you could give multiple talks about just this area. And my main point here was saying that without shared pointer, without our value references, we couldn't really deliver on the dream that was the value semantics, right? That your types could behave like primitive types. And both of those features make a huge kind of move towards allowing you to really work the way C++ was intended to, which is without kind of all that management of memory and lifetime and just taking advantage of the stack semantics and all those kinds of things that go with it. Now, so that's never saying delete again. Well, except the only place you should ever have delete, right? If you want to have a rule of thumb in your code, you could walk through your code. If you have delete in your destructors, fine. Nowhere else. Now, C++ 11, I got to get used to saying it. I've been saying 0x for 5 years now, so bear with me. We only just named it like a month ago. You can do a lot more now in terms of kind of modern high-level programming. Now, C++ has been generic for a long, long time. And it's been generic at compile time, right, rather than at runtime. And that's really valuable in terms of performance. When you create a generic vector or something like that, these are highly specialized when you compile, and they're exactly designed for the types that you're instantiating. Now, does anything in here look pretty scary? Like, does this look pretty confusing at this point? I put two examples that would be, like, you know, weird enough. So the biggest changes in C++, beyond, I think, our value references, are far and away lambda expressions and the things that go around it for generic programming. So a lambda expression, for those that haven't used them yourselves, it's a very simple and concise way of describing a function in place. So you don't have to go create a functor or another class or a function and pollute your namespace. For a lot of things, you just want to have a predicate function or something like that, and you can create that. That's what the lambda is. And I'm showing you one there at the bottom. And not only am I showing you a lambda, but I'm also showing you returning a function, right? Not necessarily a lambda. So what that second function is doing is saying, well, given a function that returns void, takes void, right? That's what that looks like. Then construct a new function, which is that lambda expression. And we'll go into the syntax in a second. And call f, and then f doesn't return anything, but I want you to return to the identity of t, right? Whatever the base definition of t is, return that, and then you get this new function returned to you that will execute and return a new output. So this is the kind of thing that is really, really powerful, right? When you can treat functions in a first-class way, this can really affect the way you program. And then the one above I show because we actually have this new syntax as part of this, which is you can now put, not kidding, you can do this anywhere you want. It doesn't even have to be kind of a fancy template function. You can now write, instead of going int foo as a function, you can now go auto foo arrow int. Now, programming language people that focus on the academics of programming languages will tell you that probably one of the biggest mistakes in programming language history was that C chose the order of declaration that it did. So the fact that the return type is to the left of the function name and the parameters is actually a tremendous problem. Not for you per se, but for compiler writers. It's actually a really, really hard problem because you don't actually know until you're on the other side. And something like what I'm showing above there would not be possible without this kind of syntax. In other words, if I wanted to say the return type of this function is based on the parameters and an expression related to those parameters, you wouldn't be able to do that if it's on the left side. And so that's why we use this kind of new format. And decltype is what this is, a new keyword that basically says evaluate this expression. It doesn't actually execute, it just evaluates what the expression's type is and says that's the type. So it can be pretty powerful. Think of it as if you're doing a matrix library or something like that, and you want it to have a plus operator on your matrix, and you want to say, well, the return type of that is based on the two types that I get in. And you wouldn't have to create all the different overloads, right? That's how you traditionally do it. Okay, now, this is all well and good, but remember, the core philosophy of C++ is that I can give you all of this while remaining efficient. If you cannot be as efficient as ever, then this is not worth your time, right? You can go to other languages to do this kind of stuff. Why not use Python, Ruby, whatever, right? So here's an interesting example in context. When I think of how C++ tackles these kinds of features while remaining true to the machine, so to speak, and true to your control, right? C++ is all about giving you control. So here's some C# code. Has anyone ever written lambdas before? Yeah? Good. So this is not that interesting. I mean, this is kind of basic code, nothing fancy here. What would you see on the screen after this is done? What do you think this will print out? Okay. Is it going to be 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9? No. It's going to be 99999? 111? 0, 0, 0? It'll be 10. Yeah? You're going to see 10, 10, 10, 10, 10. And the reason for that is C-sharp here has implicit behavior, which is when it creates a lambda expression, it captures the variable, right, the variable counter, but it captures it by reference. Even though it's an integer, right, which is a primitive type, it's capturing that by reference. So every action function, right, everything in the actions list is actually referring to the exact same variable. And so they're all going to print out the current value of the variable, which is 10. So if you want to deal with that in C-sharp, you'd have to do this. That's not so bad, right? But this is the easy case. This is the easy case. This is an integer, so it's a value type, so it's a primitive. It works like the value types of C++. If this was an actual class, like fighter, in C-sharp, this would not work. Because fighter A equals B in C-sharp would make A point to B. Right? Because it's not really a value. So the only way to do this, if you had a real type, you'd have to go, you know, copy equals new type, and then provide the value into it, right, as part of the construction. This is not ideal. C++, this wouldn't fly, right? This is not the way you would want to operate. So in C++, we added a bit of syntax that you have to think about each time, but the results are positive. So this is the same piece of code. You'll notice it's identical, right? Like there's really, the words are different, like vector and function versus action and list, but it's really the same kind of high level. And what you're seeing here is the key kind of interesting feature of C++ lambda expressions. Anyone know what that's saying? It's kind of weird, right? So first of all, this is how you declare that you're entering a lambda. First, you have to put in these square brackets. No matter what, you have to put in these square brackets. You can leave them empty, or you can put things into it. If you leave it empty, in this case, the code would fail to compile. Because empty means this lambda does not capture the state around it. It's a stateless function. If I wanted to say cout hello, I don't need anything around the state, right? I don't need to know anything that's going on around me. I don't need to bring it with me when I'm going to execute later. So then you would have an empty capture block. This can be really useful because you'll know, right? With an empty capture block, you know this lambda is not using anything around it. Now, in this case, of course, I want to use something around my scope. So I need to say that I want to use the counter. So the way this ampersand, what it means is capture everything I'm using. So I'm using only one thing here. Capture everything I'm using by reference. It's actually by const ref, exactly as if you were to take a parameter, in a function. And then if you print this out, you're going to get 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10. If you wanted it to do what I think of as, the right thing in this case, is you want to capture by value. You want to capture by copy. And that's with the equal sign. This is saying, whatever I use, capture it by copy. Yeah? You want to do both. What if you want to do both? Yeah. Very good question. We'll do that right away. You can absolutely do both. The control is fully within in your hands. So what I'm going to go do now is we're going to play around this arena. So it's kind of empty in here. My run function's empty. So what I'm going to do is we're going to have fun. We're going to create a little shell so that I can run my game. All right? So a shell is what? A shell is strings that execute commands. So what I want is a table, right? Unordered map of string to function, right? Function that returns void, takes void, and that's my map, right? And this, we'll call this the commands. Nothing interesting there, right? This is a hash table of commands. No, you no longer need a space. I have happy news for everyone. This, which we always supported in Visual C++ and our compiler, which was non-standard, is now standard. Because compiler writers up until this year apparently were just lazy. Because you could, if you work hard enough, you can make this work.
There's a syntax error on the PowerPoint.
Where?
Open the PowerPoint.
There's a PowerPoint?
No.
Are you serious?
Yeah, over there.
You're right. There's no intelligence. That'll teach me to, you know, not copy-paste the code, just type it in again. I typed that in twice. Okay, so good catch. So what are we going to do? So in my construction for my game, I'm just going to create some functions. So for example, we're going to say commands start, right, equals, and now I'm going to create a lambda. So this is how a lambda would look like generally, right? And in this, I want to create an arena, right? That's going to be the plan. So here's my do nothing lambda. This is a do nothing lambda, by the way. This is correct code. You're allowed to write. In fact, you're allowed to write all of this. That's all correct. This is the shortest lambda you can make. This is a lambda that captures nothing, takes nothing as a parameter, and does nothing. Okay? But hey, it's the base principles. So what I want to do in this lambda is, well, I need to create an arena. Now, you'll notice that now I want to create an arena, so I only want to create it once I call start. I don't want it to be constructed as soon as I create my game class. So now I need, again, more interesting lifetime semantics than what was built in. But at the same time, I don't want to share this arena with anyone. This is not like a ref count thing. I just want it to be part of my game. So we have a solution for that as well, which is the unique pointer. Right? This is also built into the standard now. And so I have a unique pointer of arena, my arena. Okay? Pretty simple. Please, yeah. All right. And so now, in here, all I do is my arena. Every time I'm going to call start, I'm just going to reset this pointer effectively to be a new arena. Right? Magical compiler. Doesn't work. What's wrong? An enclosing function local variable cannot be referenced in a lambda body unless it is in the capture list. Right? We're keeping you safe here. You're actually referencing my arena, which is a member of the game class. The lambda is not. Right? The lambda is just a generated function right here. So what it needs to do is actually capture this by copy. This is a really funny one. So this is capturing the this pointer by copy. But it's a pointer, so really it's just a number, and so no big deal. Now, someone's asking, how do I mix it up? So let me just show you real quick. So if I had a number here, int x equals 33, right, and I wanted to capture x, I could say, well, let's capture x by reference. And now I can use x, so I could put x in here. Or I could say capture x by copy. Is that clear? So if it's very, very similar to what you would do in a function. Right? And I think by and large, in really beautiful kind of modern C++, you're either dealing with a value, like as a parameter or on the stack, right? Or you're dealing with, ideally, a const ref. And so here it's kind of similar. If you do this, it's what the code that is being generated, there's no magic here. You could write this code yourself, right? It's really just a functor. And in that class, you would be initializing, you know, x would be like a parameter that you receive, and it would be a const ref. It would actually be a const ref. If you wanted it to be not be a const ref, now I'm going to kind of scare you, you would actually have to write mutable in here. And this would now say, take it by reference, but make it a modifiable reference. This is C++. I try not to show you everything in one hit, right? Usually. So we'll keep it simple. No x. But at least I've answered your question, I hope. And we'll remove this guy over here. Right? And that's it. That's my start. And let's make them go to war. How about that? Yeah? And again, I'm going to capture this and say my arena arrow. So it has arrow semantics here, of course, because it is still a pointer. And do a tournament. And that hardly has a return variable. Right? Auto. I can just use generic programming here. I don't have to know exactly what's returning at this point. And I can say fighter result arrow name is victorious. Yeah? There we go. So using lambdas is as easy as this, right? It really, I think, changes the way you do certain very typical things. So in the run code, of course, I still need to put in the kind of the shell code, and I'm going to cheat here. I'm just going to paste that in. Nothing terribly interesting in here. Right? I'm just saying print out game and then get the word out and run the command. And this is really just me running the command. Right? So we run this. Cross your fingers. Okay. I can start. That constructs an arena. I can start again. You'll notice it destroyed an arena and constructed an arena. So again, I didn't call delete. But because I replaced the pointer, the unique pointer has the right semantics within it. In that when you go reset, it says, well, I have to release the previous one I had. So I have to call the destructor on it. Okay, so if I go start again, and start again, right? Oops. And now, just so I show you, if I quit, you'll see that we constructed 40 fighters and destroyed 40 fighters. So it was operating, right? It was doing work, and it was doing it correctly. So to show you how crazy this gets, is we could even do this. This is me getting kind of too ambitious. Watch this. You ready? Can anyone guess what I'm about to do? Probably not. We're just going to go recursive. Okay? No big deal? Why not? And again, the lifetime semantics will still be correct. Create an arena. Run a new game. Create an arena. Quit this game. Destroy that arena. The other arena is still alive. Right? Then I can quit that one. And then you'll see 20 fighters were constructed. 20, you know? The lifetimes are all managed for you just correctly. You don't have to worry about it. And it's deleted exactly at the point when it's no longer used. It's not like you have to wait maybe next tomorrow that the garbage collector will get to it. So to me, this is really where it all comes together really nicely. Right? If you use shared pointer and the unique pointer, you get the kind of the customizable lifetime. But you still get all the safety that you need in order to do this kind of stuff correctly. So now we have our... I wanted to do the tournament. Come on. I forgot my tournament. See, if they go to war, it's kind of fun. I actually made that willing fully. It's actually like picking two fighters and all the other fighters are dead. You'll actually see them be destroyed here. It's actually hard for me to show you. I know what I'll do. I'll use my fun. I have so many of these. This one. All right, here, we'll see out. Fighter died. All right, and you'll see. Because I put some effort into this. See? So all these fights are going on, and they all die one at a time. And the way they die is not because I delete them. It's because the semantics of my game are such that when there is a tournament, right, I pick two fighters, and then I have this endless loop. See, right here. Right? And if you lose here, this is my full code, right? Your health goes down by one, and eventually your health will go down to zero, and if it does, then I kill you, and killing you just removes you from the list. Right? So these are the kinds of things you would do in any language to manage the context of the game. Right? It's not, I wouldn't call this kind of memory management. This is semantics of your game management. And the memory management falls out of it, and the resource management falls out of it, which is really nice. So I think the next time people tell you, oh, but it's a pain because of the memory management and all this crap, I think you would say that C++ forces you to do a little bit of work up front to think about your resources. And rule of thumb is pretty simple, right? If you see a resource that requires, you know, construction and acquisition and cleanup and release, then create a class for that one resource. Not two, because it gets more complicated there. Then you got to manage if one of them succeeded and the other one failed and all this crap. So do one for each one. It's really easy. It'll take you probably about 15 minutes. And then your code will start to become really safe and really clean. And then all those naysayers, you can tell them to be better. So all that is really great. But remember, we talk about power and performance. And can we really have performance in our day and age without being parallel? So this might be an interesting place for C++ to die, right? Where it's like, well, if all these other languages are able to be parallel and C++ can't, then I won't use C++ for speed anymore, and where does that leave us? So parallel is really important. And I'm happy to say that there's a tremendous amount of changes here. The first is, and I'm not going to go into it because this would take a PhD and I don't have it yet, and it would take another couple talks to just talk about this, but it's really important. The new standard actually finally acknowledges the existence of multiple threats. This is serious. For 15 years, C++ did not even acknowledge that they possibly maybe existed. So there was no concept in the standard for how to deal with possible reordering on the CPU, what is safe, like what does volatile really mean, and what are the barriers where volatile no longer works and where does it work. All of that has now been defined in the standard. This is a lot of work. This is kind of like not sexy work because it's not new features. But it's actually, without it, we wouldn't be able to do anything related to concurrency because we'd never know what compilers are supposed to do. So having a memory model for C++, which is the term people use for this kind of stuff, is really key. So 15 years late to the party, but we're there now. Now, what do we build on top of all that, right? So there's a lot of different approaches that people are looking at for concurrency. The first thing is to think about that concurrency, you know, there's two kinds. There's the concurrency that systems people have been doing for years, like in the operating system. I have friends that work in, you know, the kernel, and for years I've been telling them, like, concurrency is hard, and they look at me like, no, it's simple. It's just basics. And for them, the problem is very different than for application developers. In fact, they really like locks and leveling locks and doing very fine-grained things like that. But for applications, I think, to be successful while being parallel, it's a different kind of concurrency. And so the trends we're seeing now is, you know, how do we help you take advantage of, like, simple patterns? How do we help you be asynchronous? How do we help you move away from shared state towards message passing? Right? These are the ways to get the great kind of parallel correctness and performance. So, you know, I don't have 18 demos of parallel. There's lots and lots we've done. But I'll show you kind of a simple example of where our APIs are going here. And by the way, these are available in VS 2010. And they take advantage, like they're kind of the culmination of all the things I just showed you, because they wouldn't exist without lambdas. They wouldn't exist without decal type. They wouldn't exist with all those things that we now have in the language. They're actually the first kinds of libraries that we've built that take a huge amount of advantage of these new capabilities. So here's a dialog, and I'm going to have a button on it. And in this button, you're going to see the code looks the same, right? I'm just creating an arena on the stack. And here's some interesting parallel code. So this is task-based parallelism, and the goal here is to be asynchronous. I'm not trying to do highly parallel fast work. I'm just trying to do it on the background. So this is a task that returns a string. You can think of this as a future, if you kind of remember your school from parallel programming days. This is a future of string. This is saying, this is a string, just not ready yet. It'll be ready when you ask for it. And then you'll have to wait. So this is creating a task. And again, it's just a lambda, right? You'll notice here I am using the mutable concept, but I really don't need to. And all it does is return whoever wins the fight. And then here I'm actually able to, so in here, I'm free, right? Here I can, the UI will work. And when the task is done, right, and I can compose this is kind of beautiful. So a task, you can call dot continue with, and then there you can use another lambda. So you can chain these together really nicely. And I'll just write out with a message box who won. Oh, this is not. I don't think this is going to run. I'm still on the old one. Oh, no, there it is. There's my arena. And this is my GUI skills, very, very limited. And I click start, and you'll notice I can still move this around. If I shake it really fast, I think everything goes away. There you go. And then that came out afterwards. Now, of course, I wasn't doing anything interesting with my UI. But, you know, think about how you would traditionally have to do that. Right? You'd have to think about threads. You'd have to come up with a system that you're going to manage. You'd have to do a whole lot of work that was unrelated to your problem just to get the infrastructure in place for you to do this. And doing it correctly, so it works on the UI thread, and blah, 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 blah. And these libraries that we have, the one we call here is, this is a, you know, they're all part of the PPL, Parallel Patterns Library for C++. PPL.h is the header file. We think that, you know, we can help you get to the place where you need to be in terms of parallelism. First of all, we handle, by default, we handle all the scheduling for you underneath. You can still write your own schedulers if you're advanced. But by default, we have a really good kind of user mode scheduler, which has like the ability to steal work across tasks. And you'll notice we keep talking about tasks. We don't talk about threads. Because we're trying to get you away from threads and just thinking about the tasks at your application level. Because tasks are a lot easier to schedule. In fact, many tasks, that very task right here might have been running on the same thread, doubtful because of the UI part, so it would be on a different thread. But we're able to make that decision for you and be very efficient about it. Because maybe you only have two cores, and it'd be a bad idea to try to spawn off too many threads. But we can, you know, create the right amount and then move things around. And they're cooperative threads, so they can yield. And if you're really interested in this, and I don't have time to, you know, really demo it, but the where you really need to end up in here, if you want to spend the time and be very, very parallel, is then you have to start thinking about your application in terms of data flow, not in terms of code flow. And if you can do that, then you can create kind of the pipeline of how data moves in your app. And then using the agents library, which is built in as part of the parallel patterns, and this is kind of a more advanced, you know, concept, but it's really just, again, implemented in C++ with the same kind of intrinsics. And you'll be able to then describe, you know, without state, kind of, it's very much like mailboxes, right? You mail messages across, but they're all within your app. And you can build up this pipeline, and you'll get kind of the optimal behavior on all computers, right? Whether it's a 24-core that we're going towards, or, you know, a 2-core small device. I think even the devices now have 2 cores. So, C++ is really big. This I've shown you just a really kind of small set of things from the whole list. I think I've shown you kind of the biggest ones, the biggest pieces, right? So R-value references and lambdas are probably the two biggest things in the standard, but there's lots and lots of things. Now, a lot of the big features are already implemented by our compiler. R value references and lambdas, you saw me demo them. They've been in the product for over a year. Null pointer, static assert, there's a whole bunch of features that are already in our compiler. In terms of the libraries, we're also really, you know, there's a lot of these libraries. Regular expressions built into the language, or into the core library. Random, all these kinds of things that you saw. Function, right? Binding things. And as we go along, I can't announce anything yet, but we are always looking at, you know, completing this standard. And you'll see, I think all the compilers are going to slowly really adopt it now because it's pretty much done. Like I said, in the summer, I think you'll hear a formal, it's done kind of statement. But it's done enough that we know the year. So that's pretty huge. And I guess my piece of advice to you all is, you know, go learn it. Hopefully this is giving you an interest in actually playing around with more of these features if you aren't already. And think about what that quote about Bjarne was, right? About how looking at this language the same old way that we always have, you know, is just kind of this somewhat clunky but better C kind of. You know, C was still better at being simple. C++ got really complicated. What's that? There's a famous joke, right, or line for C++, which is there's a 20% of goodness in the language, but everyone's 20% is different. And I think it'd be really good for all of us to start looking at this language from a fresh perspective and think of how can we write code in this kind of this modern way and really show our colleagues and the people at large that this is a language that has a lot to offer in terms of the way it thinks about design. And I think when you can have high-level programming with performance and great resource management, I think you can really show that this is a viable, important language in our day and age. It doesn't hurt that it's supported on every platform known to man. You can't say the same about almost every other language. Okay. Happy to take questions. What about the STL? Actually, I'm not sure what you mean by that question. Yes. So the STL is formally part of the language, right? It's called the standard template library, and all these things that I describe, you know, effectively they usually kind of move from Boost into the STL. So that's really where they live. Now, They're not all template libraries, per se, but, I mean, they all have templates, to be honest. But there's the number of additions is pretty significant. So there's new big libraries that I showed you, like Random is kind of a fresh library. But within the existing ones, on vector and all those classic things, there are new algorithms, there's new containers, right? So unordered map, unordered set, and these are like hash table, hash set. Those are new, part of the STL container set. In terms of algorithms, there's a lot of kind of tweaks to the existing ones, like there's, you know, find and find if and find first, not of, and first, you know, all these kinds of great ones, and there's some good ones around kind of the map reduce concepts for accumulating, and then, well, accumulate was already there. But there's a few new kind of algorithms. All those things are either already part of our compiler, or, you know, we're rapidly moving towards integrating them into our compiler. I saw a question. Yeah. Oh, I see. Okay, so you're saying, let me see if I'll repeat the question and tell me if I got it right. So you're saying, given the vast kind of size of this new standard, are you saying there's other kind of classic, now new idioms you should look at? So I think there's a few, not all of which I can demo because they're not yet in our compiler. So I think another really, really great thing is initializers. So you know how you can create an array and you can just initialize it with curly braces, right? And you can put it in line. That syntax is now capable to be used for any type. This is, again, kind of completing that your types can behave like primitive types. So now you can have a complex structure or a vector, all these kinds of things, and initialize them in line using curly brace syntax. Where that gets really powerful is you could use that inside a function as a parameter. So you could pass as a parameter an anonymous, like, new instance of something right there. Right, so you want to create a temporary, you know, fighter of size, you know, with constructor parameter ABC. I could do that right there in line. This is really, really nice. C# has something kind of like this with the ability to create objects really quickly like that. So I think that's a really great feature. That the key reason I talk about that as in terms of idiomatic is you'll be able to use it everywhere. You know, and from now on, I think you'll find that over time people are going to just use that syntax to initialize stuff. It'll take a little while, but. Yes. Yes.
Do you understand the question?
I think I understand your question. So, I believe there is an. I'm getting rusty here in my reading, but I believe you can handle an initializer through an operator overload. I believe.
That's what I
believe you can. Yeah. I'll double check for you. I forgot, but I'm pretty sure there's an operator overload for that. Yeah. Yeah. No one can give you a talk on, like, the standard is huge. If you go to the kind of, there's a FAQ page, and you can just look at the list, it's very, very, very big, which is great. This is kind of the most significant change to the language since 1994 or something like that. Since templates, I think, were added to the language. This is the biggest thing. So insofar as we can move, right, our code to be kind of using these techniques, I think we'll really all benefit for a really, really long time. Any other questions?
What has been the trigger for this change?
What has been the trigger? Well, it's been in the making for many years. They've been working on this standard for ages.
For me, at least, the responses at the beginning of the presentation made me assume the same. It hasn't been really big in news or anything like that.
Right. So the first thing I'm going to do is get a TV channel and start broadcasting more. I think you can say part of that reason is us not being vocal enough as a company kind of talking about it, and we're trying to improve that. And I think as this kind of the standard comes through this year, you're going to see people like Herb Sutter on our team do a lot more kind of open talks about this space. And I think, you know, that's me being, you know, self-critical about Microsoft and how we didn't do enough of work to kind of move this forward. But I think the reason the industry kind of is like this is, do you guys know, have you been to the keynote, do you guys know Scott Hanselman?
Yeah.
Yeah? He's a popular guy, right? So I remember I had a conversation with him, and I was telling him, I showed him all these statistics about how C++ is still used all over the world with like significant percentage, how there are more young people graduating with knowledge of C++ than anything else, except for HTML, and I was telling him, like, this is an interesting piece of fact, right? Like, where's our community? You're this community guru, right? He knows how to get people to show up. So where are they? And he goes, yeah, I don't know. He agreed with me that they exist. But I think there's something about our C++ community that is quiet. Now, I don't know what it is about us that causes us to be this way. But I think there's something about, you know, maybe this, we're just getting real work done. You know, and you're too busy making great things happen. But the reality is, all the great software that I look at every day that I really love is often C++, right? Whether it's some competitor browser that I may or may not use, or you know, all these other kinds of things. Yeah. 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 Mm-hmm. So that's a really good question. So what happens if we fast forward a few years and everyone's using Lambda expressions everywhere and they're used in really silly ways and they get really fat and complicated and hard to debug, right? I'd actually argue that debugging is where it gets really interesting. And I have friends that write a lot of linked code, and you know, there are actually aspects. He's a consultant, a friend of mine, and he actually kind of avoids it a lot, and he says it gives him an advantage over kind of the young kids who just constantly use link, and then when it comes to debug, they have no idea what to do. Because it's this giant blob of like declaration that's just executing, and you don't know where the problem is. There's something to be said about traditional imperative code, right? Like, these are von Neumann machines, and you can step through what's happening and assign to the variable and walk it, and it's all clean. I think that's why C is still popular too. So I think we'll have to find where we land. I think Lambda expressions will allow you to use some of the features of the language that should have always been used and were not that popular. So I think, you know, calling standard sort or accumulate, yeah, these lightweight lambdas for again, doing things like an accumulation, right? A map reduce, not something really, really terribly complex. I think if it gets complex, you make a function and you call the function inside the lambda. You can do that. But a lambda is a quick way to bind the variables and call something. That's the way I see it. I had fun with this. I mean, you can go look at our blog and you can find an old post that me and a colleague wrote about memoizing functions using lambdas in C++. So this is like nested lambdas and it gets pretty out of hand pretty quickly. And this is not what the language is really good for. So I think we'll have to strike the balance between not trying to be terribly Haskell-like, but yet giving you the benefits of C++. And in the example of Haskell, it's interesting because there's two places in C++ where you can do functional programming. Right? One is these lambdas in the language, and there's another part where it's even more kind of pure functional and really, really, really hard to write, which is templates. Templates are completely, completely functional. It's like the worst functional language syntax of all time. Because it wasn't designed to be a language. It wasn't designed to be Turing complete. It just happened to be. But you can write, you know, there's a great blog post. You can go find it. It's like Haskell and C++, and you can take every Haskell kind of function and, you know, recursive function defined and translate that one-to-one to a C++ template that's executed at compile time. So I think it's all about where you want to put the effort and where you get the value. So if you can get value from compile time stuff, metaprogramming, I think that's a great feature of the language, right? No one else has that to the degree that we do. Now, it's hard to use, to say the least. But I think if you know where you're able to use it, the benefits can be huge. So I can't dictate. I really can't. I think you're right. Things can get ugly. It's C++. If it were up to me, I think the next standard we'd try to probably simplify. But I'm not. I don't get to pick those things. All right. Well, time is up. I'm happy to give my card to anyone or answer more questions here, but you're free to go. Thanks. How's it going? I hope you enjoyed that.